what we did or did not receive for Valentine's Day, so that's for the record. This afternoon, we're going to start with a, like, settle in for a work session.
Go ahead and introduce it and then go into your work
session. Okay. We have before us LC Draft 2007. And do we take testimony first?
No, then you go into your work session.
Okay. We will go into a work session as to whether LC Draft. Wait a minute.
We're going to be using this.
That draft number says this.
Use this.
LC Draft 6-1459 be introduced as a committee bill. That is the topic before us. Not the same draft?
This one on the outside of the envelope.
Could we have some clarification from the committee administrator on this?
This is 2007.
Yep.
2007?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
2007. Okay.
That's the number of the bill, not the year.
Erase the tape. Okay. We're going to start over on this one. May I?
Please.
This is a redo. We will have a work session about the draft that is before you as to whether LC Draft 2007 will be introduced as a committee bill.
I would so move, Madam Chair.
Representative March moves LC 2007 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
Could you explain to me a little bit about this?
You can have that.
Mr. Marquis, would you like to come forward and give us a briefing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Marquis. LC 2007, as written, would allow a non-resident student who is dependent upon one of their parents in a situation where when they're living with that parent and that parent is moving to the state of Oregon and would marry a resident of this state for the purposes of their tuition at a higher education, for higher education, they would be allowed in-state tuition. It also, in our first original draft, it was strictly based on married parents. However, legislative counsel said that was unconstitutional. You couldn't offer one benefit for a married couple and not for a domestic partnership. So the bill further goes in to allow this same situation for domestic partners. However, it defines a domestic partner as a couple that is living together for at least 9 months. And the idea here was so that they'd have to be living together for 9 months prior to the school year starting. And again, they'd also have to be coming from out of state. So the idea there was to just try to narrow the focus so that people weren't just moving in together for the purposes of getting in-state tuition. They would have to do some serious planning for a situation like that. It also requires that under the circumstances, whoever is being married, the Oregon resident has to have been here for at least 10 years consecutively prior to the school year starting. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Marquis? Representative Farr? Yeah.
Would this include illegal residents of the state who had moved here from another country?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I'm not specifically sure of that answer. We're looking at getting an amendment to this, and if you look up lines 13 on the first page where it says who is not a resident of this state, we're looking to get an amendment that says who is not a resident of this state and is a resident of another state to clarify that to make sure that those two issues don't align into the same topic.
Thank you, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Any further questions?
One question here.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Second page here, line 3B, entered into a domestic partnership not less than 9 months. Where the 9 months comes from? What's the basis of 9 months?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, in talking with legislative counsel, there's several different state agencies that define domestic partnerships in administrative rule, and I don't believe which, I don't remember exactly which one, but I believe it was the Employment Department listed 9 months in their administrative rules, and so that's where they pulled that language from. The other thinking was is that for the next school year, people would already have to have been formed into some sort of domestic partnership as of today's date, and they weren't just moving in together sometime in October, or I mean, excuse me, August, prior to the school year. So we were thinking that this would only affect people for the next school year, at least, that were currently living together now.
Any further questions? Representative Logan.
Do you know how long it takes to become a resident now? I mean, if they moved in to this state and they were a 17-year-old just graduating from high school, grew up in California, both parents, and that student moved to Oregon, how long does it take them to become a resident?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, it really depends on the circumstances, and in fact, California's can be a poor example just because sometimes there is some reciprocity with California and there's no requirement, there's no time frame. If you take a different state, the time frames somewhat vary. If a student was to move here with a parent that they were dependent upon, it would take a year or so. However, if the student moves here and their parents aren't moving, potentially the child could pay out of state tuition all 4 years. Depending on if they become independent themselves. If they're still a dependent upon one of their parents and their parents do not live in the state, they're going to pay out-of-state tuition all 4 years.
Representative Roland.
Follow-up on the same thing, Chair. A student who moved here who was 18 years old and lived here for a year, would they then be a resident to enter the next year?
Madam Chair, Representative Roland, it would strictly depend on... No. I guess, first off, your answer is no. It would depend on, however... if they're claimed on their parents' tax forms or not. If they are not a dependent for the purposes of taxes, it's my understanding that after a year they would be paying in-state tuition.
Thank you. Representative Mark.
I just thought I'd make a mention here for some of the folks that often we don't debate bill introductions to a great extent because, assuming this does become a committee bill, it will have to be referred back to our committee, and then we could have a full hearing and work session on that.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marquis. Seeing no further discussion, those of the opinion LC Draft 2007 be introduced as a committee bill will say aye, or those opposed will say no. Will you please call the roll, Kelly?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion carries, and LC Draft 2007 will be introduced as a committee bill. We're still in the mode of making money. Thank you. We will now move to an informational hearing, and we'll hear from the Oregon Department of Education, and we'll have a review of the Oregon Administrative Rule process, which is somewhat of a follow-up discussion from that which we had a week ago. And you may recall there was some confusion, and so I think we're going to strive to clarify that confusion and still get a little further elaboration on the administrative rule process and timelines therefore. So, looks like we have Salam Noor and Randy Harnish.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Salam Noor from the Department of Education.
And I'm Randy Harnish, also from the Department of Education.
Madam Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity to clarify for the record what the Department has done to enact and implement House Bill 2744, and specifically the modifications of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, the CIM, certificate of initial mastery, subject area endorsements, and the certificate of advanced mastery requirements. Before you, as is currently being distributed, is a packet of information that establishes a timeline and activities that the department has been engaged in for the past 2 years, in particular, relative specifically to the implementation of House Bill 2744. I want to apologize for the voluminous binder, but I want to assure you that this is actually the Cliff Notes version from the packet that we provided to Representative Flores last week. Mainly, the discussion centered around House Bill 2744 and the department's implementation and the enactment of that law. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to assure you that we have implemented the law and communicated these changes and modifications and expectations to districts on a regular basis and in a variety of ways. We use several methods for disseminating this information and for communicating with districts, including the superintendent's pipeline, the curriculum director's listserv, instructional leaders council through the Education Service Districts Network. We have the standards newspaper, numbered memos that I mentioned last time, and direct correspondence and interactions with teacher groups. In 2003, in particular, we used video conferencing to disseminate information and share changes with the field to accommodate budget cuts and travel restrictions for both the department and staff in the field. The timeline that you have in your packet, if I may direct you to the left side of your packet, this timeline in particular provides you sort of an overview of the numerous interactions we have had with teacher groups relative to changes in the law. I also want to direct your attention to the Standards newspaper article that appeared in the summer of 2003. And what we've done is we didn't provide you all the information contained in this document. We provided you samples, and we have listed them by an exhibit number, if you will. So the Oregon Standards newspaper is item number 3 in your packet, and it's on the left-hand side. And I want to direct your attention to that specifically because it deals with specific communications relative to House Bill 2744 and the changes that were enacted as a result of it. The Oregon Standards newspaper is a document that we publish annually, and it goes to every educator in the state. This year, up to this point, we published 60,000 of them, and they're distributed regularly. We provide critical information through this mechanism, and we also share changes to curriculum, student expectation, district expectations, etc. So we didn't provide you everything that's on the list, but we wanted to highlight certain pieces to assure you that we have communicated your desires and your intent behind the change to the law. The timeline also shows the various interactions that we've had with the State Board of Education, whom you have trusted and charged with the interpretation and implementation of the law. And the timeline describes the process we go through to communicate with the board, inform the board of the department's work, make sure that it's consistent with the board's expectations, seek direction and guidance from the board, then proceed with next steps. And once the board adopts policy relative to this law in particular, we proceed with the administrative rule changes, which we are in the process of doing so, and Randy will be able to address that in a few minutes. I do want to acknowledge that it did take us a long time to go through this process, and I can't really provide you any specific excuses, because I really don't want to make any excuses, but I do want to acknowledge that it's a process that took a long time, and I think if I may, it's due to a degree to the ambiguity in the law and the way it was being interpreted for the various teacher groups that would have been impacted by it. For example, when we issued the newspaper article, we received numerous calls. I received multiple calls myself from curriculum directors, from superintendents, from principals, from teachers, and advocacy groups, if you will, relative to the intent of the law. The calls, the questions that we received basically asked if district had an obligation to teach students these subjects. Now the assessment has become optional, if you will, relative to the SIN. We clarified the expectation for the certificate of initial mastery up front. The other questions that we received is if this was optional and a student wanted to take the subject area endorsement assessment, if you will, did the district have the obligation to accommodate that student? So these are the types of issues that surfaced for us that really added a degree of complexity that we had to work through. We provided that information to the state board. The state board directed us to do our own interpretation, to seek public input and feedback into that process. Throughout the last 19 months, as you will see from this document, we've interacted with the teacher groups that work specifically in these subject areas, the arts teachers, the physical education teachers, the health teachers, the social studies teachers, and the second language teachers. We were parallel to that. We were developing the standards that apply specifically to each one of these content areas. We haven't really interrupted the flow of the work, but we needed to clarify the intent of the law. The law is clear in terms of asking districts to offer a comprehensive educational curriculum to students in all seven content areas. The law also states that teachers had to provide students the opportunity to achieve their full potential, and those are my words, if you will. So we had to balance these requirements that were specifically listed as shall with this provision that said districts may offer subject area endorsements. And based on all the feedback that we received and the potential conflict in interpretation, we felt that the responsible thing to do is to go to the Attorney General's office and seek an opinion on it. And as soon as we received that from the Attorney General's office, we took it to the State Board. The State Board adopted that recommendation that clearly stated that districts may offer subject area endorsements. And if a student is interested in taking a subject area endorsement or receiving a subject area endorsement, that the district may offer that student the opportunity to do so. So the Attorney General's opinion clarified it for us, clarified it for the field, and for the State Board. We took it to the Board for adoption in January. We received the opinion in December, and we immediately asked the State Board to take action on it, and we're currently proceeding to change the rules so they reflect these permanent changes, if you will. I'm sorry I'm going over this material so quickly, but I just wanted to share with you the process. And this is really the primary reason why it took so long for us. And again, it's not an excuse. It should not take 19 months, and we acknowledge that. At the last hearing, the committee was interested in discussing mandates and requirements on districts. And I also want to share with you what we have...
Yes, ma'am. Excuse me, Dr. Neuer. Might we interject here and
yes.
time out just for a moment to address that particular piece before you proceed to mandates?
Absolutely.
Are there any questions regarding the time frame, implementing, and so on regarding this administrative role? Representative Farr.
Thank you, Chair Flores. Salem, I have a question for you. How often is it necessary to go to the Attorney General for clarification on bills that have been signed by the governor?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we typically, and I'm also going to ask Randy to speak to that as well because he handles some of the legal questions that typically arise for us. In the event that we're not clear on the intent of the law or we're not able to arrive at a clear interpretation and an understanding of what the law is intended to accomplish, and after we have consulted committee notes and committee records, if you will, and have not been able to clarify that, we seek a legal opinion to clarify it for us and make sure that we're applying the law according to the intent. Would you like to speak to that?
Briefly, Chair Flores, Representative Farr, another example of a complex bill that required us to go to the Attorney General's office for some assistance in clarifying it was the charter school bill, for example. It's a multi-layered, very complex, wide-reaching piece of legislation. And in that case, as we implement and as we begin to work through it, there are questions surface that aren't precisely addressed in the language, and at that point, the superintendent and the State Board of Education and the department's responsibility is to help clarify that and get an answer. And at that point, we would contact and work with the Attorney General for some assistance in coming up with a precise interpretation.
May I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
I know that Representative March mentioned this when the whole question arose about House Bill 2744 and the delay in its implementation. Would it make sense to have the standard procedure initially be to contact the authors of the bill, the sponsors, and ask them some of these questions and see if they can provide clarification?
Chair Flores, as Representative Flores, certainly that would make sense. To an extent, in Oregon, the case history on statutory interpretation is rather unique in that, and I can't quote the case, I believe it's Bureau of Labor and Industries versus PGE. There, it's kind of the standard case that everybody cites in statutory interpretation in Oregon, and it, in a nutshell, states that in the case that the language is absolutely unambiguous upon its on-the-face reading, that's as far as a court will look. They will not necessarily go to legal history or any of the other statutory interpretation guidelines that other states might do. So Oregon's got a little bit different kind of case law history on statutory interpretation.
But you said that was in the event that there was an unambiguous interpretation, and what you're suggesting by virtue of this delay is that there was ambiguity.
Chair Flores is correct. Where there is ambiguity, then it's incumbent on us to do that, to take that next step and to develop an interpretation that does look at the legislative history and the accompanying background information.
Let's see, Representative March had a question, and then Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, did you state when you sought the AG's opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I believe, I'm not sure, and I thought it would be actually reflected on this timeline, I believe it was in the fall of 04, and I want to say October, November of 04, because we received the opinion in December. And prior to that, we've had several interactions with the state board that directed us to go to the field and seek input. And the legislation actually directs us to collect public input and comment into this process, and particularly educators that will be impacted by it. So we did interact with the board throughout in 03 and throughout 04, but we didn't actually seek the Attorney General's opinion until the fall. I want to say October, November. And the reason for that is because we had multiple interpretations. We had internal conflicting interpretation whether the law said may or shall. We were receiving pressures from the field, the teacher constituent groups that work specifically in these areas and wanted to keep it as shall. And we've had just varying degrees of understanding of what the intent of the law was, so we felt that the responsible thing to do is to actually do that.
Representative Roblin, and then Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Chair. So the issue of ambiguity on this whole thing was over the endorsements and whether they have to be or may be provided by the district. Is that where the whole ambiguity
Madam Chair, went? Representative Roblin, yes, that is really the question that was mostly debated, was whether districts had the obligation to offer subject area endorsements to students. The law is clear, it says may, but the questions that surfaced as a result of that is what really led to some of the ambiguity relative to offering instruction on the one hand, and two, offering students the opportunity to access subject area endorsements in the event that they wanted to. Were districts still obligated to do so under the may clause, if you will?
And the final decision from the AGs was it truly was may, and there's no requirement on the district to offer them. They just have to teach them.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, you're absolutely correct. That was the interpretation, that the district may offer subject area endorsements to students. It actually also took that a step further and said that districts may require them should they choose to, but it's not a state requirement. It's a locally determined decision.
Representative
Dahlem. Have the rules been promulgated and disseminated yet? Does the school district have the rules in hand now?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, no, they have not.
How?
We, if I may continue, please. We wanted to take that to the State Board of Education to make sure that the board adopted the item as it currently stands before proceeding with the rulemaking process. And I do acknowledge we're behind. It shouldn't take us this long to do this, and this is a unique case. But do you want me to say something, Randy?
Representative Flores, Representative Dahlem, none of the requirements in House Bill 2744 with respect to what districts were currently and are currently required to do has changed. That there was no, the law did not require any additional work as opposed to actually removing some requirements that were in the process of being implemented, or it rolled out as far as the timeline. House Bill 2744, as you know, removed the requirement from the SIM for the subject areas other than English, mathematics, and science. Those three components had already been and were being implemented statewide through the state assessment system through in every school in the state. House Bill 2744 deleted the or moved from a SIM requirement to an endorsement area requirement, the art, second language, physical education, social sciences, and health. So to answer your question, have the rules been changed to reflect that change? No. But the law was it was specific, and no district was required to do anything additional and will be not be required to do anything additionally as a result of the adoption of the ultimate rules.
Follow up.
In the newspaper, isn't it reported the school district in a certain firing order, at bat, on deck, and the whole? Has that been reported to the district? Do they know that they're no longer? Is there general knowledge that they are not no longer required in these areas with the SIM? Is that generally known?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I believe it is. We've communicated this. That's the purpose of the timeline, to show you the various interactions that we've had with district personnel, whether superintendents, principals, curriculum coordinators, directors, and teachers specific to these areas. We believe that we provided that communication and have been really diligent in informing them in a variety of ways through a number of avenues that the requirements for the Certificate of Initial Mastery have changed and have been limited to math, language, arts, and science, and that these other requirements for the four subject areas have become optional. We have not put it in rule, and we're in the process of actually doing that right now. But I believe that superintendents and principals are aware of it. We work with COSA, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, the Oregon School Boards Association, and the number of partners in the field to disseminate that information. And we've done trainings on it as well. When teachers participate in one of these workshops, they're usually sent there by their superintendent or principal that's fully aware of the purpose of the workshop and the agenda hopefully associated with that workshop. So I believe that we have communicated that.
One follow-up. We're 19 months in, another 3-4 months until rules are promulgated and everything's up to speed. Has this sort of a time lapse happened before, or is this the only time you know it?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, from my experience, this is the only time that I'm aware of. And I would like to say that this is really a unique circumstance, simply due to the ambiguity relative to the intent of the law and the various section of the law that talk about what districts shall do, and this particular section that gives them the option to do so. So in my view, it's really a unique circumstance. Randy.
Go ahead.
Oh, Chair.
Oh, Representative Parr, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Flores.
Well, my question for you, I guess, is what would be an easier way to disseminate the information? Because we talked with the superintendent from Albany Schools, and she clearly did not know about House Bill 2744 and how it changed SIM to three core subjects. And I just had some people from two school districts in my office this morning that knew nothing about SIM being reduced to three core subjects either. So they must be part of the same process that you're talking about in receiving information, and yet they weren't aware of it.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, communication is essential here, and I believe we need to continue to improve the communication and expand the network that we have. We typically communicate policy changes with superintendents. We have a superintendent's listserv where all memorandums, all notifications go to directly to them, and then they take the responsibility of disseminating that information to staff in their districts. We also post information on our website, and we work with our various teacher groups to make sure that they have the latest up-to-date information. We also have a regional liaison network that assigns a staff member in my office, for example, to a regional area, to a geographic area. That staff member has the responsibility of taking communication to the field and bringing communication back to us to help inform our work. I really can't tell you specifically why the communication may not be filtering down to the levels that we would like to see it. But I would say that it's a point well taken, and we will do whatever we can to improve our communication methods and strategies to make sure that teachers that are most affected by it first and foremost actually get it. So you have our commitment to do that.
Before we move on, do you have a date certain or time specific when this administrative rule will be officially logged in and you will be issuing the numbered memorandum, which will give it the force and effect of now department policy?
Madam Chair, we're in the process of issuing a numbered memorandum that talks about what the action that the State Board took last month and clearly specifies that the SIM, Certificate of Initial Mastery, currently consists to those three areas, math, science, and language arts, and the other four subject areas are optional. We use the same language that the Attorney General provided us. That memo will probably go out today or tomorrow, as a matter of fact. We just finalized it. Randy is in the process. I'll actually let Randy speak to that, but he's addressing the rulemaking process, and he has taken some steps to make it official as well. Randy?
Randy, before you go, is it your normal protocol to take and get a department approval? I think you indicated before issuing an administrative rule that you've been now 19 months down the road on?
Madam Chair, in this particular case, we wanted to get State Board approval because essentially they were trusted in the enactment of this law and the interpretation of this law. Once we got the go-ahead from them last month, we immediately proceeded to write a memo to send that to all districts.
And we're not members of the Department of Education involved in the process. Is this House bill moved forward so that you would be cognizant of what the intent of the legislation was rather than having to seek an opinion to clarify it in 2003?
I'm sorry, madam. Would you please say that again?
As the bill was moving through the process,
right.
I would reach the conclusion that probably members of the Department of Education were monitoring this particular bill, this piece of legislation, as it moved forward, so that you were following the committee hearings and the vetting of the intent of the bill. So I'm just having a little trouble not trying to make a big mountain out of a molehill, but I think this is significant in process.
Right. Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. The one thing that I would like to point out, however, is that we have new leadership at the department, including myself, and the work and my relationship with this piece in particular. The department has gone through a reorganization. We do have new leadership, new managers and management positions, and we are committed to paying attention to those sort of things much more efficiently and effectively and diligently than we have in the past. Again, it doesn't excuse the fact that it has taken us 19 months to do so. We acknowledge that, and we will make a commitment. Actually, we've made a commitment to ourselves when we all came into these positions to look at all the rules that are in existence and to begin to revise them and bring them up to date, because as I acknowledged last time, some of these rules have been in place for over 20 years and some of them don't necessarily directly apply to the educational system that we have today or wish to have for our children. So you have a commitment from us to look comprehensively at the existing rules, to pay attention to legislation as it passes each session, and to enact that immediately with the time frame that's established for it.
And and I'm glad that we can be partners in that. But let me ask you this. In the bill was passed and signed in June. It had an effective date of July 1, 2003, and was it clearly not workable, not manageable to put it into effect at that time due to your process?
Madam Chair, I can't really say that it wasn't workable. I wasn't directly involved in it at that time.
I realize it, that.
It's something that as we reorganized the agency and redirected roles and responsibilities, my office assumed responsibility for that bill. And immediately we started working on it because we were cognizant of the fact that we were behind in its implementation. So we took every step that we possibly can, and this timeline was really was provided to you to indicate that we've been very diligent and very aggressive in its implementation. I think the department will put in place a process to ensure that when legislation is passed and signed by the government, by the governor, that we pursue the enactment of that legislation fairly quickly, and the rule adopting and rulemaking process that's associated with that.
Representative Roblin,
just a comment and a statement. When the rule was passed, the bill was passed, and became law. In schools, our SIM was made up of math, English, and science. And science had just come in. We were looking forward to having social studies become a part of it and foreign language. Neither of them had yet. And so nothing has changed. The SIM that was offered to students in 2003 is the same one that will be offered in 2004 and 2005. So from the standpoint of, I think, some of the things that we're looking at, from the school's perspective, it looked like a delay, because before, we had delayed implementation of social studies in particular from an original date to a later date. So when I think in the school's perspective, it was seen more as a delay as opposed to it's really changed. So a lot of people haven't necessarily caught up with the changes. The other thing that I note is that I think that we sometimes don't understand here at this body and at the State Department. Sometimes they do more. How big an impact these things have, not knowing. Most of the high schools in the state of Oregon rearranged their whole social studies department based on an expectation that social studies curriculum was coming in. From U.S. history, which was traditionally a junior subject, to forcing part of it down into the freshman and sophomore year because the tests were going to come at that. And you had to have them taught before they were taking the test. To the dismay of many social studies teachers. I mean, it was a big issue in our schools. It took a lot of energy and time. And other people were working hard to get theirs in. Foreign language, for example, really wanted it to be a state standard because that would force every school to have foreign language. And they were really distraught when they heard it wasn't going to be a requirement. Mm-hmm. Some of us administratively said we couldn't figure out how we were going to find enough teachers to do it. So it was a godsend in that way. So all of these things happening, and it's important to get the rules out. But with regard to what we were doing in the schools, I think what they have said is true. It didn't affect us because we were given a SIM on three subjects only. The frustration is I wish that we all knew clearly what that meant, and that's where the rules come out. That would have been helpful. That's just my comment.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I just wanted to make two points, I think, and one is that I'd heard secondhand that the superintendent that was here the other day did actually later remember that she had heard about the bill. But it was a question of maybe never had seen any final rules, and so she was probably addressing that issue. But secondly, I think the message is clear that we are hopeful and will be sort of semi-insistent that this is the exception rather than the rule in your rulemaking process. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Now with that, Mr. Harnish, you were going to talk about the mandate situation. Is that what you're going to, were you wrapping up here on this discussion?
To be perfectly honest, I forgot what I was going to say.
I'm sorry.
What I would like to say, Chair Flores, is that the State Board of Education will meet on Thursday of this month. Our intent is to have a temporary rule before them at that time, and as well to file permanent rulemaking next month and begin that process so that the permanent rules will be in place within 3 months. But for your kind of edification, if you understand the distinction between the two rules, the temporary rules the State Board of Education or any agency can adopt for a period of up to 180 days, and then those rules expire at the end of that term. But we can do that on kind of an expedited process. We can at the same time begin the permanent process so that we have a rule in place, the temporary rule, while we can finish up the adoption of the permanent rule and hopefully have that done at the quickest timeline possible under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'd like to share with you very briefly what the department intends to do relative to mandates and requirements. And that was the topic of discussion at your meeting last week. I also want to stress that the department that these requirements are based on state statutes that are enacted by the legislature. And the State Board of Education and the Department of Education are entrusted with the implementation of those statutes. And part of that is the development and the adoption of rules that help inform and communicate what the expectations are to districts. I mentioned earlier that we have new leadership at the department, we've gone through a fairly significant reorganization that I believe it will make us much more efficient and much more effective in terms of how we manage the agency and deliver services to the field. We saw that as an opportunity to look at everything that we do, not just how we do it, but actually what we do. And one of the things that we've made a commitment to doing is a complete revision of Division 22 requirements and look at the changes in education that have occurred over the last 10, 15 years in particular under the implementation of the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century. And those rules, as I indicated earlier, define what a standard district and a standard school is and establish uniformity across the board. Now, we have made that known to the field for about 7 months now, and actually we've solicited input and feedback from superintendents, principals, and any interested entity out there that would like to share with us their suggestions and their recommendations for how we modify the existing rules. And we will always make sure that they are consistent with the statutory intent and the legislative intent for that law. I indicated that we've completed a preliminary analysis that looked at the rules and started to establish a taxonomy of what we would consider to be really urgent, things that we needed to address immediately, things that are not as relevant and can wait a little bit, and things that are actually secondary and they can wait a little bit longer. But we wanted to approach that in a very comprehensive and very holistic way. We want to look at the rules in terms of currency, relevancy, and also a possible differentiation, because they some sort of a weighted approach, because not all the rules are equally important, if you will. Some are essential, some could have a secondary role. So I just wanted to share with you that we've started that process. We've had an internal group started on that work. We have a plan to roll that out and actually form a larger group that includes external stakeholders. We're very interested in having principals, superintendents, and teachers be a part of that process, because we value their input, we value their perspective and the expertise that they bring to the process. And we hope to actually make a lot of progress on that work in the next 4 to 5 months. And we'll be happy to come back and share with you our progress if you wish.
I'm sorry, when did you say you began this process of the review of the Division 22 requirements?
We did that actually last year. We had a small group of staff that actually did a preliminary analysis, not very extensive. And based on their analysis, we determined that we need to take this, we need to enlarge the group and have external input into the process. It's not something that we want to do ourselves. We want to involve stakeholders, principals, superintendents in particular, that actually are that work in schools on a daily basis and regular and can actually inform the relevance of these rules. So we started that last year, and right now we have a plan to roll it out to start including external stakeholders.
So you've been having ongoing meetings since last year crafting this plan?
No. Madam Chair, Not exactly. We basically decided that this is a project that we wanted to take on, and therefore invited a small group of staff to look at it and do that preliminary analysis. Since then, we started working with the state board to inform them that this is the direction that we would like to go, and they've actually agreed that they would like us to proceed and review those rules. Currently, we're at a stage where we have a plan, and we would like to form a group that involves internal staff and external staff to start looking at them and revising them and offering recommendations.
Is that plan something that is a public document at this point or an internal working document?
Madam Chair, it's an internal working document, but we will be happy to share it with you if you would like.
I'd be interested.
Okay. We'll be happy to provide you that.
Representative Dahlen?
Will you have some legislative recommendations out of that body of work?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlen, that's really an excellent question because the rules are a reflection of the statutes. So when we make any proposed modifications, when we propose modifications to the rules, some of them may require some statutory changes. So we anticipate coming before you and before the appropriate bodies to make those recommendations.
I will really look forward to that. It seems as for 1993, the Oregon Education Act had an outcome base, and Division 22 is more the Carnegie unit base. It seems like there should be some marriage of the two. I'm not sure that's possible, but I will really look forward to that, and that will be in April.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlen, we'll be happy to provide you a report in April on our progress.
I'm looking more for the legislative recommendations so that we might study them also.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlen, we'll bring you forward whatever recommendations we have. We can specifically provide you at that time. I'm not quite sure what the process will actually entail or how extensive this is. To be able to say for you, to you for sure, that we will come back in April with all the recommendations, but we will make an effort to have those rules reviewed and have at least a preliminary recommendation by April.
I'm very concerned that you get here before June 10th because we will be adjourned June 10th.
Well,
yeah,
you're here.
Well,
sounds like more committee bills in our future.
Exactly.
Yeah. Any additional questions of either Dr. Noor or Mr. Harnish? Well, thank you very much. I hope you don't feel that we've been giving you a lot of grief. However, we need to have a better handle on these things, and I'm hopeful that you understand that from our perspective as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We certainly do. We appreciate your interest, and we appreciate the interaction. You have every right to be concerned, and we want to provide a quality service to you and to the public as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of the House Committee, if there is no other business to come before us this afternoon, we will stand adjourned.
That's good.